Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck, and I am the host of this show. My special guest this evening is Chuck Panacchio, Executive Director of Healthcare for All PA. A few weeks ago, we had the new president of Healthcare for All PA, David Stile, on this show. For those of you who need a good education on what single payer is and how it will solve many of our budget problems, as well as a civil approach to humanity, please give a listen to that show. Chuck and I will discuss the economic impact study, which will prove just how much money single payer will save Pennsylvania. And we will also discuss how we can energize the single payer movement here in Pennsylvania. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Chuck Panacchio. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, Kate. How are you this evening?
I am wonderful. How are you this evening?
Good. Terrific. Thank you.
Good. Well, as we have discussed many times, we are so fortunate to have an actual bill here in Pennsylvania that could eventually, and we hope will eventually, bring single payer to the state of and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which is House Bill 1660. And Senate Bill 400. So, and you've been working on this for a very long time. Would you say how many years, Chuck?
4.5 years, a little bit more than that, I'd say. But others have been at it for quite a bit longer.
Mm-hmm. And you are quite the, you've put so much energy into it, and so many people look up to you. I was actually watching some of YouTube videos of your talks on single payer. I think the last one that was on there was in August or so. And you had predicted in those videos that our then governor would be signing the bill in November. I was wondering if you would be willing to adjust your prediction on that one.
Right. Well, that obviously didn't happen. The governor didn't register common sense, which is what single payer is all about. And I think it underscores, as virtually everybody who is listening this evening and follows our politics, it underscores the disproportionate role of campaign contributions and organizations, especially insurance and pharmaceuticals and allies, to give money to politicians and expect something in return for those monies. So unless we get the public funding of elections, it's going to be that much more difficult. But quite frankly, I think that we're going to get this bill done before any other major economic or political reform is done. So I'm actually encouraged by the current environment.
Good. Well, speaking of the current environment, our new governor here in Pennsylvania, Tom Corbett. I'm just wondering, how is the climate now in Harrisburg that, as it pertains to single payer? Have you noticed that the people newly coming into leadership positions, are they more open or are they more closed to the single payer initiative?
They're more closed, actually, which is kind of a strange response given what I just said a minute ago, which is that I'm actually encouraged. The problem with what's going on right now is that the Tea Party has hijacked the Republican policy-making process and has moved it dramatically to the right. And the Democrats are in the minority now entirely. They've lost the governorship and they lost the House. They had previously lost control of the Senate. So our Harrisburg is now entirely in Republican control. But the point that I'm going to make throughout the call this evening is that this is not a partisan issue. And that the politics that we're talking about, this dramatic shift away from government doing anything of a constructive nature, that it's completely unsustainable. Frankly, I think it's going to accelerate the crises that we're faced with, not just healthcare, but our economy, our environment, our school funding situation. These are issues that are going to come to a head now much faster than would have otherwise been the case. And once we produce the economic study, the economic evidence to demonstrate that the single-payer solution, publicly funded, privately delivered health care for all, quality comprehensive care where you get to choose your physician, the government raises a fair share tax, everybody pays their fair share. In fact, people will be paying less for health care under our legislation than they currently are and get more. And everybody's being covered. Everybody will be covered under our legislation. Hospitals won't be closing. Doctors and nurses won't be leaving the state as they currently are in dramatic numbers. So this is by far, far and away, the most obvious political solution within our grasp. And it's going to be screaming to be heard from as these crises get deeper and deeper. So I'm actually encouraged because the politics have kind of shut down, have shifted dramatically in an even more partisan way, an even more polarized fashion than they have previously. And I think that this is the storm before the calm that we're going to have to see, that we're going to have to experience. So I'm actually quite encouraged, believe it or not.
Well, the encouragement might come because people, the general public, is getting a little up in arms. They are seeing what happens when they aren't engaged in their democracy.
That's right. I believe that all great societies, all great nations, all great states and peoples and communities respond out of crisis in a way that is completely unexpected, in a way that forecasts our future. Out of crisis comes opportunity, and I believe that we have unprecedented opportunity. And I think it's really a matter of recognizing that opportunity and being prepared to work through the existing mechanisms and actually to be creative outside or even on the margins of our political process. I do think that people are going to have to be more creative. We even talked about this a little bit earlier today. I think that we're going to have to be more bold in how we express ourselves because the mainstream media is inclined not to look at issues that challenge their very basis of existence, their funding basis, their advertisers, their closest friends, the benefactors of the mainstream media. So I think that a lot of what's going to happen is going to begin off the television screens. It's going to begin off of the radio band. It's going to begin off of the more traditional communication methods, not all that dissimilar to what we've seen happen in Tunisia, in Egypt, what we're seeing happening all across the Middle East, and that's having ripple effects all across the world. We're just getting disproportionate coverage in the Middle East, but it's empowering to people everywhere around the world what's going on right now. I mean, these global revolutions that we are living through right now are unprecedented. The last time we saw this kind of convergence of revolutions was back in 1848, and that was by and large restricted to Europe. What we're seeing today, more than 150 years later, are revolutions that are rippling across the entire globe. And I think that we have got within our grasp here opportunities that most people cannot yet see because we're so close to it. And in some ways, we've become kind of shut down in how we process information. I think a lot of people are feeling very disempowered, very discouraged, not seeing much honest dialogue or discussion in our political quarters, let alone the mainstream media. But I think that we're very close, actually, to a positive, explosive, energy that's going to lead to forward change, progressive change.
I do too. I have a now. The reason we one of the reasons why we wanted to get together on the show, you and I, was to do a mini fundraiser for the economic impact study, as you recall. So I have some people here in the chat room, and I'm putting up the link, healthcareforallpa.org/donate.htm, even though on that page it doesn't say that it's specifically for the economic impact study. Certainly, if that is the way people want to put their money, they can actually specify, I would think, somewhere on the page. Now, tell us, where do we stand here in Pennsylvania with the economic impact study, which will help everybody see the money that will be saved by passing such a bill, the bills that we were discussing?
Right. Healthcare for All Pennsylvania, for folks not familiar with our organization, we're an all-citizen, nonprofit lobby and education group. So we have a political advocacy arm, and we have an education arm. And our education arm, the 501c3, the education fund, or the Healthcare for All Pennsylvania Education Fund, as the group is known. It's tax-deductible contributions to Healthcare for All Pennsylvania, Healthcare for All PA Education Fund. We're in the midst of a capital campaign right now, raising money to do an economic impact study. And our goal or objective is by the end of May to raise $50,000. And we are now in the neighborhood of $15,000 toward that $50,000. So we're on track for raising the money that we need to get this economic impact study done. And it's the economic impact study that's going to demonstrate the cost savings, the deliverables in healthcare, the fact that we'll be able to keep our community hospitals open, keep doctors and nurses practicing in the state, make Pennsylvania the most attractive state in the union for businesses to stay and to set up operations. And this will take the burden of healthcare costs off of off of individuals, off of small businesses, off of institutions of education. All sorts of benefit will come to everybody in our society once we pass single payer and the fair share funding and delivery of healthcare is then guaranteed. So the economic impact study will demonstrate in hardcore fashion the ideas that are written into Senate Bill 400 and House Bill 1660, job development, healthcare delivery, and as well, you know, one of the issues that a lot of people are just now beginning to pay attention to are these pension issues, and healthcare benefits that follow people into retirement. As it stands right now, many businesses, manufacturing businesses here in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, as well as governments, municipal, county, state governments, have obligations to cover pensions and health care costs that are simply unreachable at this time. I mean, they only have set aside a tiny fraction of the amount of money that needs to be paid out to retirees in the form of pension and health care. Single payer will alleviate that burden immediately and enable our institutions, public and private, to survive, to function, to deliver, to serve our communities, and to continue moving forward. So single payer is as close to a panacea as there ever has been in our society.
Right. Well,
it's extraordinary where we are.
I guess you're aware that Donald Trump, over the last day, says he supports single payer. Now, he has not backed down from that statement because he's getting all kinds of flack from the conservative movement, or not, I don't know how many, but he's been getting some flack, and he was on CBS News this morning, and he stood by his statement about single payer. He, as a businessman, knows more probably as much as anybody, or maybe more than anybody, how we are not competitive anymore in the world because of our bad healthcare system. And it's not the bad healthcare system. Let me just say it's the access to the system that is terrible and the expense of it. He may be the lightning rod to get people interested in this topic again, especially if he isn't backing down, which he doesn't seem to be.
Yeah, how ironic that is at this point. I know that once he made his announcement known that it would be coming, Republican rank and file immediately rallied to Donald Trump. He is the front runner for the Republican nomination. And again, that underscores the point that we made earlier, right, which is that single payer is not a partisan issue. It's a common sense issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very exciting in a way.
Yeah, well, we're going to have, lots of strange bedfellows are going to come together and see the light, and those people who are fearful throughout our society are going to follow. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
always
mm-hmm.
been the case that people who can see clearly, who have a vision, who understand what's working or what's at work, what the problems are, and understand how the solutions fit the problems and solve the problems, it's always the 5% who lead the way. And it's your followers on your blog, on this radio program tonight, that are going to help lead the way by supporting our economic impact study. And we do need to get funds into that, and we need folks to kick in whatever they possibly can. And we really would like to encourage people to contribute on a monthly basis because it becomes a lot more manageable. People can budget it to continue supporting both the economic study as well as our critically important education and lobbying work going forward. So if folks can think in terms of whatever they can handle on a monthly basis, I don't know anybody who can't handle $5 a month. And I know mm-hmm. it's a stretch for some, but that's what we need people to do, $10 a month, $15, $20, $25. Folks can do $100. And if people can make one-time donations to get our economic impact study launched, you know, if people have a chunk of change coming back in the tax return, that's what we desperately need at this point. This is the trigger. This is what's going to get us over the top.
Yes. I had a thought that, let's get back to a question Tom and I had about, I think that alternative healing is not necessarily covered in the bill as well as we would like it to be. And, my husband Tom was saying that John Mackey, who's the former president of Whole Foods, had taken a poll amongst his employees to see if they supported single payer, and they said they were interested only if integrative medicine was part of the equation, and so as it stands now, you know, the medical field is so rigid that a lot of us don't. I wouldn't go to the doctor unless I was mortally ill, even if I could pay for it, even if there was a single-payer plan, just because it's so incredibly black and white. So Paul Wellstone, in his single-payer plan back in the day when he was still alive and he had one, included alternative medicine, included integrative medicine, and that was something that would be very cost-cutting as well. As preventative. So I was wondering, when I talked to Dave Style about this a few weeks ago, he was not so clear on this question, and I was wondering if you had any further light to shed on this, on that particular.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I listened to that interview as intently as a lot of people did, and I think Dave, if he were to come back on, would tell you that he didn't quite appreciate at that time what the bill already had in place and what we've included in the rewrite of the bill. Our bill will be reintroduced, Senate Bill 400, House Bill 1660, will be reintroduced. The Senate bill will be reintroduced within the week, and the House bill will be reintroduced within the next 2 to 3 weeks. We just are looking to time it to coincide with certain activities going on in the Senate and the House. Mm-hmm. But the bill, as it was previously written, absolutely gives control, self-referral. There's a self-referral mechanism in the legislation, and this includes alternative medicine. What the bill rewrite has done is that it gives greater power to patients, I mean actual patients, people who are recipients of healthcare, who deal with healthcare issues. I mean, we're talking specifically about people being on our board, our advisory board, and our action board, who are recipients of long-term care. They're receiving psychology services, psychiatric services, chiropractic, alternative medicine. I think you talked, didn't you talk about homeopathic, I think you were talking about?
Homeopathy, yes, that the Queen of England and many people in the UK use homeopathy. It works, and it, as I just said, these things are cost-cutting even more than what the single-payer bill, if people were able to use those things, if these things were covered, it
right.
would even be more of a cost-cutting situation.
Yeah, I think the point that Dave was making was that if you can demonstrate, if you can put forth evidence, as you're telling us right here, and I'm aware of many of these studies as well, that alternative medicine is absolutely central to to patient care, to patient-centered care. I have chiropractic treatments at least three times a month because I've got a carpal tunnel condition that mm-hmm. traditional medicine doesn't deal well with at all. I've done physical therapy. I've done occupational therapy. I've done acupuncture. Acupuncture is a great pain reliever. It's very much helped me. But chiropractic has been the single best method of dealing with my carpal tunnel condition. I'm beyond the ability to have an operation because I don't have a classic condition. But there are people who fall outside the bounds of these black and white areas that you describe.
Well,
and
yes,
we need help.
And there's people who do not want surgery, even if their condition falls into a situation where they could or should or recommend it or whatever.
Absolutely. Right. So the emphasis here is on choice and diversity of choice, and that includes alternative medicine. But the bill does not preclude, it does not say that you cannot do alternative medicine. What it does is it gives an evidence-based frame for the advisory and the healthcare board to make decisions on what
mm-hmm.
is considered in what is considered healthcare, appropriate healthcare for people's conditions. So the board is not going to create a one-size-fits-all, absolutely not.
The National Institute for Health, NIH, has been doing
right.
studies for years now for proving the effectiveness of alternative medicine on patients. And also, Andy Weil in Tucson, Arizona, is the head of alternative or integrative medicine at the University of Arizona in Tucson. So he's done all kinds of scientific work to prove the effectiveness. So these studies are out there. They've been there for years. All we have to do is pull them together and
right.
And look at them, you know?
Absolutely. And if you look at the bill, that's the process is in place to do exactly
yeah.
what you say, Kate. So Dave, at the time when he interviewed with you, was just then becoming familiar with the bill. He had just come on as president of Healthcare for All, PA. And what we've done since that time is Dave Stile, Walter Sue, Dr. Walter Sue, many people familiar with Dr. Walter Sue, who's a national single-payer expert, the former
mm-hmm.
Philadelphia Health Commissioner, who goes after the giants in the industry, the insurance and pharmaceutical giants, and challenges them at every step. Walter is the number one testifier for John Conyers, H.R. 676 in Washington, D.C. But what we've done, Walter, Dave, and myself, is we sat down and we rewrote the bill to make sure that the decision-making and advisory structure is going to focus on evidence. It's going to focus
right.
on what it is that provides a path toward healing. and we're going to set aside the conventional, you know, Western-style rigidity of our current healthcare delivery system and focus on actual healing. So the emphasis here is on choice. The emphasis is on evidence, and the emphasis is on the patient, not the payer, because that's the problem with the current system, is that the insurance industry has hijacked healthcare delivery by emphasizing profit, profit, profit. And the way that we're going about this is we've written legislation that frees us from that profit-centered focus of our healthcare system. And so the problem has been, I think, too, that a lot of people confuse, and even in language, we talk about healthcare and health insurance as if they are one and the same. And this is a problem. And we really need to overcome this sort of socialization of how we think about healthcare. Health insurance, as you know, and your smart listeners and blog readers know, health insurance is not healthcare, even though the health insurance industry markets itself as a deliverer of healthcare, which is a complete absurdity. They're not doctors and nurses. They're in the position, their role is to maximize profit. Whether it's a non-profit organization like Blue Cross Blue Shield, there are four of them in the state, and they control 86% of the insurance market, this absurdity, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Consortium, 86% of the market, they act exactly like the profit-first, profit-centered insurance industry. And their job is to make money, not pay for health care, and absolutely not deliver health care. But what they've done is they've created marketing campaigns that continue to confuse us. And we don't have enough courageous leaders out there, and certainly not enough voices in the mainstream media to correct how we think about health care and emphasizing health care. The money has come to dominate the entire discussion. And it's destroying not only our health delivery system, as I mentioned, but it's also destroying the larger economy. We're now spending 17.5% of GDP on health costs, and about a third of those health costs are specifically administrative. Well, the administrative costs associated with Medicare is about 3%. And in fact, the administrative costs in Taiwan are 1.6% of their total health care spending. 1.6% is administrative. Here in the United States, it's 35%. And that's and about a third of the population is either uninsured or underinsured, and that's where you get that number. With the money's there.
Yeah.
The money's there, and the science is there, but the folks who control the economic levers in healthcare and the decision-making or lack of decision-making or lack of patient-centered care are the ones who have literally hijacked the system. They game the system. They make campaign contributions, and they expect, and in most cases, they have the expectation fulfilled by politicians who are in key power positions within the legislature, whether it be Harrisburg or Washington or some other power center. They pay for their politics. They pay to make sure that those industries are not only reformed in a positive way, but are actually reformed in a way that benefits the very industries that are in the process of destroying our healthcare system and the larger economy.
Well, just to think that this healthcare bill that you have, you and your and Walter and David and others have systematically going through line by line and kind of pulled it together so that it is a patient-centered, truly patient-centered, because, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric, has been a lot of rhetoric in the medical field for years about patient-centered care, and in reality, it's not. And what you have with medical workers all through the system is a systematic burnout. And you could call it a moral dilemma because we know what is right. And maybe some people can't put their finger on it, but what we see is, you know, a lot more suffering and lots more disease and a lot more. We see the personal face to this problem as healthcare workers. And as you and I were discussing earlier, that is what may be missing in energizing this debate, is the personal face to the problem. People who are the people who are actually suffering and falling through the cracks and dying,
right,
may be difficult for people to face. But
right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
But,
and so long as they're discussed only as statistics, there really is not the urgency and the personal story to illustrate what's actually happening. I mean, these are our family members, these are our friends, these are our neighbors, these are people who have given their lives to the local community, and they're going into bankruptcy, and they're suffering. They're dying, and they're suffering in the corner. And this is the numbers of people who have always, they've played by the rules of society.
Right.
They've been
right.
victims of really a bait and switch. They pay. I know that at my university, we were just hit with another 20% premium increase. Well, the insurance company, IBC, Independence Blue Cross, they came at us and said, well, we want you to pay 60% increase in premiums over last year. 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we ended up negotiating 20, but we also lost in terms of having to pay more for meds, upfront costs, higher copays, higher deductibles. I mean, the reality is that these are real people who are suffering, and they need to have their situations remedied. That we need to value people, not money. And sadly, tragically, our system rewards people who have more money, not personal stories. More than 50% of the personal bankruptcies are now directly related to medical costs that people simply cannot pay.
Right.
You know, my mother, I'll bring my mother into the equation. She passed away a couple of years ago, and she did so because she simply could not afford her medicines. She could not afford her care. And
mm-hmm.
there are any number of people who fit that description. It's a tragedy. All of us are at risk. And I don't think
yes.
most of us realize that.
It's a denial. It's too painful and so difficult for people to really face. And it's
sure.
denial. And there's so many things in our society to become diversions that take people away from facing the truth. And,
right.
you know,
right.
we can go through that whole list of things. Television and the availability of pharmaceutical drugs, and a lot of people are over-medicated, and
right.
so forth and so on.
Sure.
Well,
I come back to the point that we both highlighted and on the front end here, which is that we're at an extreme opportune moment. We're in a time right now where the world is moving very quickly, and if we're prepared to take action, we will win. If we're not
yeah.
prepared to take action, we will not. And really, it does boil right down to that. It's critically important that that your listeners, that your blog readers, that folks who are paying attention, who do understand the way that our politics works, is that we've got to put ourselves front and center. We can't allow ourselves to be discouraged. We have to make ourselves present. We need to show up at these meetings. You know, the phenomenon that is covered in the media, way out of proportion to its actual numbers, of course, is the Tea Party movement. And
yeah.
the Tea Party movement galvanizes this amazing attention by the mainstream media. The media is absolutely head over heels in love with the Tea Party movement for reasons that I cannot entirely understand. All we need to know is that that's the reality. That 100,000 anti-war demonstrators can come to Washington, D.C. and not get a single line in a single print media, mainstream newspaper, magazine, or get any coverage on TV or radio. 100,000 can come and demonstrate in Washington, D.C. 250, and literally that was the case 3 weeks ago, 250 Tea Party activists showed up for a press conference, and every single news outlet in the country covered that press conference. 250 Tea Party folks, 100,000 plus anti-war demonstrators. The Tea Party folks got all the attention. The anti-war demonstrators didn't. The point, though, is that what we have to do is create our own media. We have to generate our own activities. We have to lobby. We have to learn. We have to use facts, because that's actually ultimately what's going to motivate or move politicians. If you can demonstrate, and this is the reality of our politics, the vast majority of politicians are not going to respond to immoral argument. Much as they should, they won't, because their first duty to themselves, I mean, this is the way our political system works, is to get elected and reelected, and that's their focus. Because our campaigns are so dependent on money, private contributors, it makes it extremely difficult to overcome, but it absolutely can be overcome if you show up with more people in the room. And you have to stay after. You have to be persistent. So whenever I do events, healthcare events, Tea Party folks show up in the room, and I welcome them. You know, because they've got what I would call a rather unfocused anger, but they're frustrated. Well, folks across the political spectrum are frustrated. They're not. They don't have a monopoly on frustration, on anger, on even resentment. The politics that we are that drive us apart from one another is this tendency to finger point and to blame the immigrants or to blame people who actually are getting health insurance coverage for their cancer, blaming them as opposed to the insurance, the pharmaceuticals, the companies that are actually crushing our system. But what we have to do actually is to welcome the conversations with Tea Party activists, because the reality is that once they understand this common sense solution, the vast majority of them are drawn to it. And they realize just how disingenuous, how dishonest the conversation is in Washington and Harrisburg. How Republicans are talking absolute craziness about health care, and Democrats are not being truthful either. And that is a fact. You know, that's the reality. It's up to us citizens. It's up to us to get the system back.
Well, this brings us to the age-old discussion amongst progressive, liberal people, is we need other parties, because the Republicans and the Tea Party certainly is, maybe that's the thing. You had asked the question about or wondered why the Tea Party was getting so much press. Well, the fact is it is news that we have a third party in this country. We need other parties in this country, and maybe because they filled that empty space, that's created quite a stir.
Well, actually, and in fact, the Tea Party is simply the right wing of the Republican Party. That is literally the case. It's not an independent party.
Right.
And I won't deny that there are grassroots elements, but it's also an AstroTurf movement. It's also a movement that is heavily funded by the Koch brothers, among others. I mean, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars, and you've got all these people who are out there, you know, with wielding pitchforks, angry, and they're doing the bidding of corporate America.
They don't know it.
You're right. But what's happened, and this is what we've discovered in our conversations in Harrisburg and Washington, D.C., and by the way, we go to Washington because we need members of Congress to give us enabling legislation to allow the states to innovate. This is one of the reasons we deal with members of Congress. And my local Republican congressman, Mike Fitzpatrick, has agreed to give serious consideration to what we call enabling legislation to allow the state of Pennsylvania, among other states, to innovate with single payer. I mean, we're making forward progress here. He's put his staff together with a leading Democrat. So actually, there are bipartisan activities, but you're not going to read about them in the mainstream media because the media is not interested in resolution. They're interested in conflict. They're interested in people slamming on each other. But the reality that we're hearing from Republicans is that they are afraid. They are genuinely afraid of the Tea Party, because they're afraid that they will be primaried, that they will be challenged in the next Republican primary. And that's a dread fear of any career politician, to face a primary as an incumbent within your own party. So the Tea Party is, in fact, virtually all Republican. They pay lip service to nonpartisanship, but every Tea Party member I've talked to is, in fact, a member of the Republican Party. But what's interesting is that much of the anger they feel, people across the political spectrum feel, and they recognize the common sense nature of single payer, which is to streamline the bureaucracy, radically streamline the bureaucracy and allow the patient to be the center of healthcare decision making and to have the power to be part of that decision making process, to restore the relationship to the between the provider and the patient, whether it be a doctor, a dentist, or a nurse, but allow that conversation, that relationship to grow, to develop, to build trust, and to make common sense decisions based on what the patient needs. But currently that's not the case. But you have that conversation with Tea Party folks, and they'll say, yeah, that's what we want. We want choice. We want the ability to control our own health care. That's a point of agreement.
Absolutely.
In addition, the Tea Party folks recognize the value of innovation at the state level. This is one of the real powers of the state-based single-payer movement. This is one of the reasons why Healthcare for All Pennsylvania has been so successful at winning over many Republicans. We've gotten 8 Republicans to sign on with the legislation itself, and we got more than 50% of the Republican Senate to sign on with legislation to move forward on an economic impact study. Unfortunately, the chair of the critical committee where that bill goes has sat on it, and that's why we have to pursue an economic impact study through private funding. And that, again, is the appeal that we're making tonight, which is having people, you know, give whatever they possibly can to Healthcare for All Pennsylvania, both our education fund as well as our lobby arm, or either or both, but it's the education fund that is funding the economic impact study. We've got to get the study done so we can take these numbers, proven, demonstrated numbers, and march them around repeatedly, constantly, through press conferences, through letters to the editor, through radio talk shows, through blogging, through face-to-face meetings, and demonstrate that this is the way forward, not only for our healthcare system that is going to be patient-centered, but also for our economy, which will generate jobs, because about a third of the population is entirely left out of healthcare delivery, with the exception of people who show up at the emergency room because they've got nowhere else to go. So it's win-win-win all the way across the board, and the Tea Party folks actually get it when you have a calm discussion with them. The problem in these meetings, these large meetings, is that emotions get the better part of people, and it's not a very calm environment. And the media loves it. They eat that up. They love the screaming matches. They even love the fist throwing. They may deny it, but they love it. It makes copy, it makes pictures, and it sells copy. And that's the problem. You know, we have to have dispassionate conversations based on evidence, based on facts, and based upon grounds of agreement. But most of these institutions don't want us to come together, don't want us to have conversations. But recognizing the Tea Party really is the right wing of the Republican Party, in fact, it is, and then beginning to reach out to those people who are angry with the status quo and recognize that it's the career Republican politicians as well as the career-minded Democratic politicians that are really the problem.
That's right. And it could really be that single payer would be the thing that would unite us through a voice like Donald Trump, because you talk about the fear of the Tea Party. He is not afraid of them. So when, you know, especially when he was getting all that flack for saying he was for single payer, he didn't seem like he could care less. So that's important. And if everybody could come together on a common ground, having that common ground be single payer, that would be quite the uniting influence in this whole thing.
I think it's an extraordinary development. And you know, too, that it's part of Trump's calculation that he wants to distance himself as clearly as possible from Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, was the lead architect of the Massachusetts bill.
Yeah,
which is what
Obama's thing is.
Exactly. Before Obamacare became Obamacare, it was Romney Care. This is the great irony, right, is that Romney is considered by most analysts, he's considered the front runner for the Republican nomination. And his proposal and his bill in Massachusetts, like you said, Kate, is the very basis of the national health care bill that we have today and is sometimes derisively referred to as Obamacare. And
yes,
what Trump is doing is I think he's really recognizing an opportunity. I mean, it's political opportunism for sure, but I don't care how he gets there, and I don't frankly care how we get there, as long as we get there.
Yes. So, yeah. The thing about the little I read about it, I didn't see Trump or anything. I was just doing some reading. We got rid of Comcast. But he says he wants nothing more than to repeal Obamacare, which really is not going to benefit anybody, and go with a single-payer plan like they have in Canada and throughout the whole civilized world.
Right. Well, that's pretty extraordinary. I mean, I haven't read it myself. I want to read up on it. I want to understand exactly what he's saying. But I think it's important to demythologize what's going on in Canada, what goes on in Western Europe, what goes on across the whole of Asia. But the reality is that each society needs to come up with a solution that fits the culture of that society. And what we've done is we've come up with a plan here in Pennsylvania that is very well suited to the American experience, which mm-hmm. is where the government plays a facilitating role of collecting fair share health care taxes. And that's what they're called, taxes. Hello, that's just what they're called. And it's the only way that we can raise the funds necessary to pay for health care. But in fact, people will pay out far less in taxes than what they're currently paying out in premiums, copays, deductibles, and, oh, by the way, being in danger of medical bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy because of medical costs. We eliminate all of that, the premiums, the copays, the deductibles, and the medical bankruptcy. Well, so what we do in our plan is we emphasize the government's role as the administrator, streamlined administrator, raise the funds and create a fee-for-service system so that people get what they need and they get it when they need it. Mm-hmm. And the private delivery of health care is emphasized, which is unique to America as well, which gives the patient the central decision-making role. So it's publicly funded, privately delivered health care for all. That's it. It's really mm-hmm. common sense. And hopefully, right. you know, hopefully Donald Trump has been reading our website and he gets the common sense behind this. And it would be a delight to have a Republican lead on this as we're working on doing here in Harrisburg.
Yes. How difficult do you think it would be to get Governor Corbett to get on line here with this?
It's a huge challenge. You know, I think we'd be kidding ourselves to think otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, he's awash in corporate contributions to his campaigns. He's taken in untold hundreds of thousands of dollars from the insurance industry, from the mm-hmm. pharmaceutical industry. And these folks don't give political campaign contributions without expecting something in return. This is quid pro quo politics. So it's going to be a challenge, but when people organize, come together, and we break this lock hold that the Tea Party folks ironically are holding, they're actually pulling the Republican Party to the right against their own self-interests. This is the strange thing about our politics. But the Tea Party folks actually want the very same outcomes that single-payer will provide, and yet they've fallen into this trap of believing that government is inherently evil and the government can do no good. Well, that's to ignore our entire history, and
yes,
that's to ignore
Let me just say that it's not just the Tea Party who has a profound distrust of government. It is pervasive. Most people do not like the government.
Instinctively, we're conditioned to think that way. So you're right. When people are asked the question about government role, there's an instinctive reflex that's negative. But when you ask mm-hmm. the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, tenth question, which is being aware that without government, we would not have public schools, do you now support government? Yeah, I do support government. If it weren't for the government, we wouldn't have our roads and bridges. Well, yeah, I see the government's got to play that role. So in other words, when you get down to the specifics,
yeah.
when you get down to what it is that people receive from the government, suddenly they're pro-government. But you're right, emotionally, right off the top of their head, most of us are instinctively, but I'd say socialized. We're conditioned to think this way. We've been beaten over the head with this belief, this idea that government is evil. Well, without the government, we lose World War II, period. End
yeah.
of discussion.
Yeah.
And the world is fascist, right? I mean, this is reality. Let's be real. And without the government, we don't have the GI Bill, which allowed 12 million veterans from World War II to gain to become middle class participants in American society. They were given loans, cheap loans to buy homes, to set up businesses, and they were given free higher education. Just like that.
Right.
Because the United States emerged out of World War II as the single standing economic superpower in the world. And again, government plays a facilitative role, a role that promotes entrepreneurship, it promotes innovation, it promotes and greases the wheels so that people can move forward in their lives and not be stuck in some sort of a feudalistic order. And quite honestly, that probably defines our healthcare system right now. It is a form of feudalism. We are stuck. We're enslaved to the system. Go ahead.
And enslaved to jobs that people don't necessarily like or love because they...
Job love.
Right there, that squashes innovation, 100%.
Absolutely, and it drags on our productivity. It drags on our creativity. It drags on our energy. It drags on our ability to function as a society. Absolutely. And people are hanging on to jobs, as you suggested, for one reason primarily, and that's they're afraid if they lose their insurance, they'll put themselves at risk, their families at risk. And then if they change jobs, then they're faced with a period of uncertainty, because most jobs will tell you that, well, you're in a holding period right now for the next 3 to 6 months until we decide to hire you permanently. You're going to have to do without health insurance. Well, I've taken my kids this year. My daughter had a serious breathing problem. I had to get her to the emergency room. Well, you know, our health insurance only covered 20% of that. So we were on the hook for $1,400 that we did not have. And then my son slashed his finger. He was working on a project. He slashed his finger with a screwdriver. And it was a deep enough cut that it wouldn't stop bleeding. And he ended up needing 2 stitches. Well, I just got the bill in the mail the other day, Kate, and that bill came to $1,484, and we're on the hook for about $1,200 of that.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, but this happens to people every day.
I know.
Multiply it times millions, and that's what we face every single day. And we're being bled to death. We're being gouged by greedy. That's what they are. You know, I mean, people can call it moralizing, you can call it what you want, but the reality is that these businesses, we're talking about health insurance companies, are in the business of making money, first, second, and third. And it has nothing to do with health care itself. That's incidental to the process of making profits. And frankly, it's within the law. That's their fiduciary responsibility to their board members and to their stockholders, and that's
right.
just what they do. It's not illegal, but it is greedy, and it's got to stop. We've got to take the profit out of healthcare. We've got to restore the relationship of the patient and the provider and give the patient the ability to get what they need when they need it without going broke in the process or bankrupt and destroyed.
Yes, there isn't enough outrage concerning the health insurance industry as there is outrage about the federal government. Isn't that interesting?
It is. And it's not a coincidence. I teach a class called Politics in the Media, and this phenomenon occurs over and over and over again. The corporate malfeasance in the early 2000s, you had the WorldComs of the world, you had Anderson Accounting, you had Enron. Front page news for 6 weeks, Kate. I don't know if you recall this. People listening may well recall it. For 6 weeks, and suddenly a national crisis pushed those stories to the back of the pages of newspapers and magazines. And what was the crisis? The abduction of blonde girls, throughout the United States. I mean, literally, it became an obsession of the media. And in fact, these abductions represented a downward trend. I mean, the trend goes back to the early 1990s. In fact, child abductions were on the decline. And yet you had Bill O'Reilly screaming from the housetop that, my God, all of our children are at risk. They're all going to be abducted. And guess what? It becomes a distraction, and we don't focus on corporate malfeasance. It's not a coincidence. It's not even a conspiracy. It's an open conspiracy. It's out there. It's just, it is what it is. We don't have the ability, because of who controls and who owns the media, to have the spotlight on corporate malfeasance for any extended period of time. We just don't. And so it's very difficult to get a true spotlight on the issues. But, again, that brings us back around to the need to get funding for our economic impact study. We can get single-payer passed. Once we get single-payer passed, we will get this burden off the backs of individuals, families, and businesses, and we can get back to what it is that we need to do, and what we need to do in our society is recover our economy and restore some semblance of normality, some semblance of stability. And once we win on single-payer, all issues are now on the table. You know, we need to turn over our society and refocus our efforts into building communities, rather than just enabling the most powerful forces in our society to take our communities over. We need to give power back to the communities, and I think that the critical first step really is healthcare, because when you stop and think about it, at least 98% of us are in the same boat, all except the super wealthy are in the same boat here. We're all at risk.
Well, also, the most important thing any person can have over anything is their health. It's far above money. It's far above, how many cars you have in your garage. I mean, if you have your health, you have everything, and that is what this is what we're actually saying by having such a program, such an opportunity here in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely.
That health comes
right.
First. The patient comes first. How you want your health care to look is your business.
Right, right. And this is part of the founding, this is part of the social contracts, part of the founding social compact that our nation was built on, the general welfare, not corporate welfare, the general welfare, the well-being of our people. I mean, we here in Pennsylvania, we live in a commonwealth, not a corporate wealth, a commonwealth. We live in a state that from its very origins, by the founding of William Penn, were committed to tolerance and focus on common need and common ground. In fact, Pennsylvania, among all the colonies, was the most middle-class centered of all the colonies. And it was a society that you didn't have these huge gaps in wealth between the super rich and the poor. You had a society early on, really from its very founding, that was focused on addressing basic needs and bringing communities together. And that's a larger purpose, I believe, that single payer will help us restore a historic understanding and a delivery of a contract that has been set aside, unfortunately, in the modern day. So we do need to get support for the economic impact study. It really is our next critical step, and we would love people to go online or to make contributions. At your site, is that where you've got things set up?
No, it's at your site, healthcareforallpa.org/donate .htm. And your webmaster could, what I would like to see him do is to make it a little clearer as to donating for the economic impact study. I'll speak to him, you know, I'll get on his Facebook page or whatever and ask him to do that. And then we can keep the pressure on to get people to go there and donate. So that's what
right.
we'll do.
Good. Well, all the donations that go to the C3, which is the nonprofit, which is the tax deductible, the education fund,
we'll do that.
C3 activity. All of those monies will find their way to the economic impact study. So people can feel confident, should feel confident that any contribution to the Healthcare for All Pennsylvania Education Fund will be the source of getting to our economic impact study, which is the next critical step in our campaign to winning single payer.
Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate your time here. It's been a delight to have you here. And as usual, you're the greatest teacher on earth. I just love the way you teach. I could listen to you teach history forever. So thank you. Thank you very much.
You're a sweetheart. Okay, I appreciate it. And all the best to your listeners and your blog readers. And let's go get single payer. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to play music for Mother and Child.
Thank you.